and welcome to the Nostalgia Interview. And today I'm talking with your regular host, Chris Deasy, about his radio interests and specifically growing up in the 1980s with BBC Radio 1, how that evolved into becoming a listener of BBC Radio 2, and how being a contestant on Blockbusters guided Chris towards his own radio career. And you told me you started listening to BBC Radio 1 back in 1981, but your love of music itself predates that, correct?
Yeah, that's right. No, and it's great to meet you again, Craig. Yes, I mean, 1981 was the year of the Royal Wedding. It was the year when I was just about turning 8. The Eurovision Song Contest was won by the UK. Of course, at that age, I was too young to be allowed to stay up. But Bucks Fizz, Making Your Mind, it was one of those kind of moments that was all kind of replicated. Looking back, admittedly, we look back on that sort of episode with the skirt moment where I don't think you'd get away with that today. But it was one of those sort of things that seemed iconic. And for somebody 7 or 8, I'd watch the TV in those days, listen to the radio, and just think, there is a whole world out there that I have yet to navigate. And I think it was one of those things where maybe my sister, who was 3 years older than me, had listened to the charts on a Sunday in the days when Tony Blackburn used to count down, and of course famously referred to their up-and-coming band Duran Duran, and I think I may even have heard it on that evening, I'm not sure. Certainly that in my mind, that was very much the era. So I was completely caught up in this world where songs would go up and down the charts, and you'd think, I really like the sound of that one. And if your favourite song was going up towards the number one position, you kind of felt that you were riding on, I guess you could almost call it like the zeitgeist. It was a sort of, there's something going on here where I was very young, I didn't quite know what world was there outside my home and family, but it was something that I was connecting to virtually through the radio every week. So it was very much a sort of 7 or 8 years of age thing in the days when, of course, you could record through a small tape recorder. In, you know, you could record what was going on the charts. A lot of my contemporaries did that on a Sunday afternoon, and in, you know, with Bruno Brooks or Mark Goodyear as we headed throughout the 1980s. So that was something that seemed very much of its moment. Radio in the days before social media, in the days before YouTube, seemed to be, if you really wanted to be aware of what was going on musically, then listening to the Radio 1 breakfast show, listening to the charts on the Sunday, seemed to be the most opportune way to do that.
And at that time, for people who live in 2023, how important was the top 30 or top 40 compared to now?
Well, I mean, it's so funny you ask that, because these days, of course, the chart isn't even on a Sunday. I think it's on a Friday. In fact, we're talking on a Friday afternoon. And the fact that I don't even know if the charts are on says something, because a few years ago, I almost wouldn't let my parents take me on holiday because I'd say, well, but the charts are on at 5 to 7. I have to write them down. And of course, apart from teletext, if you missed the charts in those days, that was it. I mean, looking back, there obviously would have been music magazines and indeed newspapers. But I wanted my own bespoke way, my own way of concretizing this radio experience. And so I'd be writing it down using different colours, actually. So if a song was going up the charts, I think I used to put them in, I think it was pink, if it was purple, if it was going down, brown for a non-mover, black for a new entry, and green for the occasional re-entry. And so that was something that was very important in an age when if you didn't catch it live, then really you missed the opportunity. There was no BBC catch-up opportunity. So in schools, on a Monday morning, we'd all be, well, actually, of course, in those days, the charts came out midweek. It was on a Tuesday. So it was only later in the late 80s, 87, that the charts came out on a Sunday. But we'd all be gathered, in some cases, in the playground at 12:45, on a Tuesday lunchtime. I remember Gary Davis, who of course is still on Radio 2 as he now is, and we would listen and we would wait. And the one that I remember most, 1985, Dead or Alive, You Spin Me Round Like a Record. That was, I remember listening to that, and then going back, I think we had like a Welsh class in school at 1:30 after lunch, and everyone was saying, Chris, so what's number one this week? And I'd say, you'll never believe it, it's Pete Burns and Dead or Alive. And they said, no, you're kidding. And I said, but if you don't believe me, I think like Peter Powell or Bruno Brooks will be counting it down again tonight at 6:30. So it was that kind of world where, you know, sometimes the radio, unlike today, where my children who are very young do not listen to the radio, they'll just switch straight onto something like YouTube or Netflix. But if you wanted to know what was going on in the world in those days, radio always seemed to be the most obvious point of entry.
Yeah, definitely. I can associate with that. My interest in sport from a very young age made me a listener to radio too. I wasn't particularly interested in anything else they had, but it was the only place a lot of the time you could get live sports coverage, especially in a world where we only had, the mainstream TV channels, three TV channels at that time as well. So that's definitely something I can associate with. When you look back at the time you began getting into Radio One, did Radio One actually reflect the zeitgeist of living in the early 1980s? Because perhaps a criticism that's often thrown in retrospect is it was somehow a little detached from what was actually going on in the wider world.
Do you know, I was just thinking that the other day because I saw an old clip of Top of the Pops, which of course in those days was presented by all the Radio 1 presenters. You have David Travis, Mike Reed and so on, and Jimmy Savile. But some of them, of course, looking back, were a lot older. I mean, maybe actually age-wise, they were no different than some of the sort of the Vernon Kays of today and so on, who seem far more sort of hip and sort of far more understanding of contemporary, youth culture. But in those days, there were a lot of presenters, of course, made their name on the pirate ships. They were older presenters who were presenting shows aimed at a demographic significantly younger than themselves. And I think you're right, but in those days, they were the people. We didn't choose. We didn't elect who was going to be presenting the breakfast show. We were given a particular presenter, and that person was with us to guide us in as we got up in the mornings and got ready for school and indeed on the drive into school for 4 or 5 years. So in a way, it's only looking back that somehow these presenters perhaps didn't entirely represent the generation. I mean, when we got into things like house music in the late 80s, which was never my kind of thing, some of the same presenters, Mike Reed and others, were still on Radio 1 in those days. But I always sort of wondered at the time, were they kind of evolving? Annie Nightingale certainly was evolving with the music that was going on. But I did wonder sometimes whether, particularly after that famous Frankie Goes to Hollywood controversy, when Mike Reed, there was this sort of like urban myth that he banned it, but he had no power to do that, but he didn't want to play it. But, looking back, that kind of feels like something that would be almost a sort of embarrassing and odd if it happened now. It seemed to be very much somebody who had an awful lot of influence, a lot of power. He was a brilliant presenter, but maybe I didn't represent the zeitgeist. I was not the sort of person in school who was the coolest. Maybe that's why I enjoyed the radio so much. I was never the person who played sport. I was never the person who sort of got chosen for football teams or anything like that. So somehow what my understanding was of my go-to people were, I think, people of an older generation, rather than necessarily what was going on then. I used to love listening to the charts, but I'm not, I think my tastes always have been, and certainly still are today, very kind of middle of the road.
At the time, did you realize there was a slightly patriarchal streak among the presenters and the format? Was that something you only look back in and now recognize it? Yeah. when you look back,
do you know, it's funny you say that, because in 2010, when Chris Evans moved to the Radio 2 breakfast show, his slot at 5 o'clock was taken by Simon Mayo. And I think at the time I thought, interesting that you really do have a pretty much entirely male makeup. And this was in 2010 on daytime on Radio 2. You'd have Sarah Kennedy, who then Vanessa Feltz, who'd be on very early in the morning. Joe Wiley, maybe a little bit later, was on in the evening. But all the daytime presenters from breakfast through till drive time were male. And I think on radio, and I suppose you had Gloria Hannaford on Radio 2 in the 80s and for the first half of the 90s. But on Radio 1, there were certainly female presenters. Jackie Brambles came along in the late 80s. Annie Nightingale was always there, but she only really had one or two. Was it like Mailbag on a Wednesday and of course a famous Sunday evening request show after the Top 40? Liz Kershaw had a spell on the station as well, and I suppose did co-present the, and perhaps co-present is the key word, the weekend breakfast show. But you're right, and I suppose I was aware of it. But also it was one of those things that was just the way things were, because it seemed quite normal. If Radio 1 had an entirely male lineup, but Radio 2 was full of female presenters, I think it would have been more of a thing. But it almost felt that Radio 2 had some excellent female presenters, but they were kind of few and far between. Often the stand-ins would be female, but Gloria Hannaford was you know, in her slot, I think, for 13 years, from about 82 to 95 on Radio 2. And she was replaced by a woman, by Debbie Thrower. But then Ed Stewart's show got expanded, and we didn't have any daytime regular female presenters for quite a few years. So it's kind of was a thing, but I do agree that it's looking back that I'm much more acutely aware of it, because it just in those days seemed to be the norm.
So you and I have spoken before about, in my case, commentators who had an influence on me at a very formative age. And I was privileged enough to be in a position where I actually had access to many of them, to a degree that I imagine millions of people who listen to Radio 1 wish they would have had access to the DJs at the time. When you were young, and I guess you were 8 when you said you began listening to Radio 1, who were your favorite DJs back then? And now when you look back at their work, do you still feel the same way about them, or has your view of their work evolved over time?
Do you know, actually, it hasn't evolved, and in a good way. In other words, I thought the presenters who I thought were outstanding in those days, many of them are still alive, and many of them are still around doing radio shows. And when I listen to them, I see immediately what I was attracted to. And when I listen back to some of those old programmes, when occasionally you get hold of them on YouTube, etc., or through the various retro radio stations. So a particular presenter for me, who was on at 5:30 or 6 o'clock in the morning, with Adrian John, and he used to do the early, the equivalent of us, which you call it, the Dawn Patrol. It was the early breakfast show, the early show, and he was on Radio 1, I think 82, Golden Brown Stranglers, I think was the first song he played, and he was there right through till 89, and he was the sort of presenter who occasionally would be given daytime slots, like he'd take over the breakfast show occasionally from Mike Reed. When Simon Mayo took over, and Mike Smith before him, he would often appear on the breakfast show. I think he actually used to do the travel occasionally on Simon Mayo's breakfast show. And he had a weekend slot as well. He'd sit in for Peter Powell. But he was one of those presenters who never made it into the big time. But he was the sort of person, I guess what he probably did, would turn up in the morning at sort of 5:30, 6. I don't think he came in with a script. But it was that sort of time in the morning. He was probably on his own in the studio. And that what you'd have was a lot of stream of consciousness. He knew his listeners, the regulars, the truck drivers would write in. I listened back to some of his old programmes that I recorded from around 1988, during lockdown, actually, when I went through a lot of my old collection. And what really stands out there is somebody who was very aware of his listeners, was speaking to them directly. The best presenters do that. And that's one of the great things of live radio. They really know their audience. These were the days when you didn't really put people on the air. You didn't have people contacting the program through email, because we didn't have email. You didn't have live radio sort of interactions, where these days somebody will play a radio. I've listened to Vernon Kay the other morning. You know, he'd play a record, and then 2 minutes later, he'd then start reading out messages from the listeners relating to that piece of record that had just been played. So it's instantaneous. But in those days, it still felt instantaneous. And there'd be travel news, and then the presenter would sort of almost give his own commentary on the journey into work that morning, and the various truckers or the other drivers or the other pedestrians or so on that he met on along the way. So I was intoxicated by this, because this was somebody who sounded very, very real. I'd never met and have never met, but somebody who had the same friendly demeanour every morning. And you always thought, something that Sarah Kennedy always said, that she always used to imagine that she was talking to one person. I don't know if she had a gender in mind. It may not have been either male or female, but it was just a listener. And that listener she would talk to as a friend. And of course, all the many millions of listeners would think, this is my friend. So I think that Adrian John captured that. And the reason I think I liked him so much was because he was in that kind of slot where most people or many of my friends at school didn't really listen. So it was almost like I would love listening to him early in the morning. But it was one of those things that was like, well, you know, he's like this treasure that had yet to be properly discovered by other people. So it felt a little bit special that it was away from it wasn't one of the obvious answers that you would give. And I just thought that he deserved to be up there with the greats from that era.
You mentioned earlier that you used to write down the charts every week. And I know from a young age, you've been a diarist as well. Do your diary entries have any comments about the presenters from the time and what your thoughts were? And when you go and read back the diaries now, do you see your your understanding and appreciation of the presenters evolve over time, or are there comments about how perhaps Mike Read changed his style, which, to be honest, I can barely imagine Mike Read changing his style, but you know what I'm saying.
Absolutely, I do, and it's so funny you asked that question because I went through all my very young diaries. So I started writing a diary in July 1982, just at the end of my primary school year. So I was 9 at the time, and that diary, which covers the summer period in 1982, is full of me writing down, this is the program I listened to, this was Top of the Pops. And what I actually did, and I can't draw, in fact, and that's not me being modest, I cannot draw, but I would do a picture, which was perhaps a bit more of like a stick person, of the presenter of Top of the Pops that week. And it would say, and I had a little arrow saying, this is Mike Read. And then I'd put some sort of fancy Top of the Pops logo together. And then I'd write down the top five or the top 10. And I'd say which of the songs that I particularly enjoyed on that week's episode. So even before I started writing down the charts, which was a bit later in the 80s, I was still very much influenced by that. And there were even diary entries. I think it may have been around the time Mike Smith took over The Breakfast Show. So that would have been around about 86. And my diary would include things like woke up in the morning while waiting to be told to get up or whatever, listened to a competition on The Breakfast Show. And I was even saying things like, and the listener was from Derry in Northern Ireland or whatever it might be, and they scored 14 points or whatever on some round. And of course, looking back, I think that's a little bit obsessive and odd. But actually looking back, I'm so glad I had that because that gives me a sense of what was going on in the days when, you know, we don't have access to the programmes to the extent that we do now. So I was mesmerised by all of these radio conversations, the interaction, the handovers actually with presenters. What are the things they talk about? Do they just talk nonsense, or are they excluding the listener when Mike Read and Simon Bates or whoever it might be are handing over at the intersection of their programmes? So in a funny way, it's not so much that they evolved, it's more that what evolved around them was a lot of things in culture and music. And of course, there came a point when maybe their shelf life did come to an end. But for somebody at my age, I did genuinely think that they would kind of go on forever because I'd known them my whole life.
And I want to touch on that in a second regarding the presenters. Now, I've been in preparation for this interview, I've been looking at some old episodes of Top of the Pops. And one of the things I've noticed still in the 1970s, and I'm guessing into the early 80s, I've seen one or two examples. Top of the Pops had a solo presenter, and then maybe 83, 84, they went to two presenters. In retrospect, you mentioned about having a handover between presenters on Radio One. You began having this interaction on Top of the Pops, between these two presenters. I look back now and I wonder, was that actually the beginning of the end for some of these presenters? Because whether they got on in real life or not, it isn't the point. Ultimately, some of these handovers were pretty unspectacular. And it was clear, especially on Top of the Pops, there weren't necessarily two presenters who gelled very well. Do you think this was a good move to go to to two presenters at that time with the staff Radio One had?
Yeah, and what was so interesting sometimes is that those presenters on Top of the Pops were not often the ones who handed over to each other on the radio. So you'd see, I think Adrian John very, very rarely did Top of the Pops. I think he did it once in like 1988 or thereabouts, and he wasn't on with the Breakfast Show presenter that he was, you know, regularly used to talking to. It might have been, I think it was like Bruno Brooks. So you'd have these two presenters who were on TV together. You'd actually see their faces. You'd see what they looked like in the flesh when I was used to hearing them on the radio, but they were doing some sort of banter that was a little bit artificial because, of course, they're doing it for the cameras and there, and you can see them almost like accentuating their hand movements as they sort of point towards the next actors on the stage. They had like 10 seconds to do their link, but you'd be watching them doing this. But on you think on the radio, I don't think I've ever heard them speak to one another. So this was a whole new world. It was a bit exotic because it was sort of like the only way sometimes you actually got to see what it was like for these presenters to interact with each other outside of those small 30 seconds or a minute or so that you might get between some of the programs. So it was almost like rendered flesh, but in a completely different context. And most of the people watching Top of the Pops wouldn't have been aware as I was. Well, I was watching it as much for the presenters as for the acts. I mean, and I think it's important to say that. When I wrote down, I used to write down all the often the news readers and all sorts of stuff, but I'd write down the Top of the Pops presenters, because I also had the charts in a different format. So for me, those combinations were interesting, and I'd go through and think, oh, this person's with that person. They've never been paired before. And yet this person's done Top of the Pops 9 times in the last year, but this is the first time they've been paired with such and such. So that was kind of an interesting way of almost like an extension and indeed an augmentation of what was going on the wireless.
Taking that a step further, because I used to do a similar thing with sports commentators. And for instance, on Match of the Day, I would note down, well, Barry Davis covered this match, John Motson covered this match. And I sort of began coming up with reasons as to why they were being sent to certain matches. And, you know, this was like when I was 9 or 10. And thankfully, because I had some contact with some of these people a year or two older, I actually found out some of my reasons weren't too far, you know, weren't that inaccurate. Have you found that yourself when you look back, that some of the theories you had when you were maybe 10 or 11 actually panned out to be the case?
Well, there was always this rumor, we know now it's not a rumor because I think it's been corroborated in autobiographies by Tony Blackburn and others, but John Peel and Tony Blackburn famously didn't really get along. Although Tony Blackburn, when he was in hospital recently, because he was off air for about a month, he uploaded something onto, I think, YouTube or Facebook, in which there was a duet of him with John Peel, I don't know when, but performing You Don't Bring Me Flowers, you know, the Barbra Streisand, Neil Diamond song. So I wonder whether they did kind of get on more. But famously, there were various presenters who was, you know, Simon Bates, and there were a couple of other presenters who apparently didn't get on at all. So when they'd have the Radio 1 Christmas dinner that was pre-recorded but was broadcast on Christmas Day, and it was obviously pre-recorded, but you'd have whoever the main host was, let's say Mike Reed, who'd then be interviewing all the other presenters. You were just sometimes aware there that the way that they spoke about certain of the presenters was sometimes in a way that they were perhaps a little envious of them, or they didn't like them, or there was a little bit of, they were almost overemphasizing the fact that this particular presenter, you know, was known to be particular about certain things or particular about music or so on. And certain reading autobiographies, I think I remember reading, I think it was Bob Harris's autobiography, when it was pretty clear that he didn't only not get on with Bruno Brooks, but there was some big legal thing about the record collection. I think that Bob Harris owed Bruno Brooks some money, and this is all in his autobiography, and Bruno Brooks bought or took away his entire record collection or something like that. So all of these things came out later on, but I guess you were aware of these at the time sometimes, because sometimes on air there would be these offhand references to presenters not necessarily being particularly warm to one another, and they used to get away with things in those days which were appalling, like using the accents of other presenters. Like Nicky Campbell once said that whenever he'd meet some of the established presenters, of course he was Scottish, they'd start doing some really awful and caricatured and embarrassing Scottish accent, in a way that now you'd think that is really in bad taste, but in those days it was just thought to be part of the general camaraderie.
Right. You know, we mentioned John Peel and Tony Blackburn, and I've actually worked with Tony Blackburn a little bit in the past. And from what I've read and from what I know of Tony, I've never met John Peel, but they were both almost commercial animals in a BBC setting. And they may have not got on, but I always had the feeling they knew they didn't get on, but they also knew how they could kind of turn that to an advantage a little bit without over egging it. And so I wouldn't say it was staged between them, because I have the feeling they probably didn't like each other very much, but I think they probably played that up. In the social history of football, there is a generally accepted precept that anyone you interview about the history of football, the greatest World Cup they ever watched was when it was the World Cup closest to when they were 10 years old. And I think, you know, I found that certainly the case. Do you think for listeners of Radio 1, there were the golden era of Radio 1 fell into when they were a particular age group?
Yeah, and I think that when you've got presenters like Tony Blackburn, who were there from 1967 up until 84, he knew he was being prized out, because he was offered the show that it was actually my favourite programme, which was Junior Choice, and on the Weekend Breakfast Show. It had a slightly different name by that point. But yeah, you're right. And I think some of these presenters perhaps thought, I found this in reading Johnny Beerling's autobiography some years ago, that he thought that the problem was a couple of the presenters kind of thought that because they'd been there since the beginning, that they kind of deserve to stay. that, and of course, ironically, you do have, I think Annie Nightingale started in 1970, but she is still on Radio 1, but she really has evolved, and I think that she is unique in that respect. You mentioned Simon Bates, who you know, does some local radio and sort of moves around different networks, but he was, for many years, you know, he was the presenter who did the mid-morning show famously, and he was sort of one of the key and the established presenters on the network, and he eventually did go in 93, and I think he sort of jumped perhaps before he was pushed, but it's very, really fascinating to sort of grow up with these presenters who mean so much because they're on in the kitchen when you're, you know, getting, having your breakfast, or in the car on your way to school, the people you talk about, and then suddenly find that actually maybe that they've been told that, that maybe they're no longer sort of right for that network. And yet someone like Alan Freeman, who was in his early to mid 60s at the time, returned around the time I was doing my GCSEs. This would have been in January 1989. And so he was this veteran presenter who actually preceded Radio 1. He did all the sort of the pick of the pop stuff, the charts, well before the establishment of Radio 1 and 2 in 1967. And my parents would listen to him when they were very young. So suddenly his return to the network, and sometimes he'd sit in for Simon Bates, he'd do a couple of the other slots on the network, seemed quite incongruous. But I always gravitated towards those more established presenters. They, and Johnny Walker, of course, is in his very late 70s now, and he's still on Radio 2. And of course, he went away for a bit in the 70s, obviously before I was listening, and then returned with his Saturday sequence in the 80s. So I was always excited by those presenters because they carried so much history with them. And you, in listening to them, you knew that they were very established presenters. They were really the, you know, the top of their game.
What was it about presenters like Simon Bates, Dave Lee Travis, Mike Reed, and Bruno Brooks, just picking four examples, that they didn't move the ball downfield as time went by? Were you aware of that as a listener, as you became older yourself, that these guys were quite no longer, maybe not quite as relevant as some of the newer presenters? And do you think they realized it themselves, or do you think they had this belief that they were the star of the show as opposed to the music?
I think I can trace this back to 1989 when Bruno Brooks, there was some documentary which included some presentational sort of intro by the then director, Johnny Beerling. And he referred to how Bruno Brooks was someone that he'd recruited, I think, from Radio Stoke. And he was this very, very sort of fine local radio presenter who was good enough to be on Radio 1. So that was sort of, I think, 84 he joined Radio 1. So by 89, he was, you know, he was presenting the top 40 on a Sunday. But they took away his tea time show, his drive time show, you know, 5:45, which I'd listened to after Newsbeat. And at the time, he was replaced by Mark Goodyear, who's a very good presenter, but a very different sort of style. And they moved Bruno Brooks. They kept him on the top 40, but they moved him to Weekend Breakfast with a co-host. And that was Liz. Well, it was Mark Goodyear and Liz Kershaw at first. And then Mark Goodyear took over the Bruno Brooks weekday show. And then Bruno Brooks and Liz Kershaw were a very good team. And they got on very well and made a lot of, you know, made, you know, good work of that slot on a weekend morning. But, you know, this was a presenter who was clearly relegated. And then a few years later, I was at university at this point, and I'd started to gravitate towards Radio 2. I remember there was a news bulletin, and they'd mentioned that there were some changes at Radio 1, and that Bruno Brooks would be taking over the 4 a.m. early morning slot. And at the time, I thought, I think he may have been carrying on with the charts. I think Mark Goodyear did it for a few years, and then Bruno Brooks took it back. And at the time, I was thinking there must have been some sort of negotiation going on here, that he was being relegated, but he said, OK, I'll do the 4 o'clock slot, which is a demotion by any standard. But it's like when a government minister is, you know, if you go from being health secretary or foreign secretary to being chief secretary of the Treasury or something, you know, it's clearly a demotion, however you look at it. But he kept on, kept doing the charts on a Sunday. But I kind of thought something was out of alignment here. And of course, you've got to make way for new blood. But it did feel as though there was an end to that kind of era. And the fact that I no longer listened to Radio 1, because Radio 1 at that point was moving in a direction. It was the music scene when I was at university. It was the club scene, the house scene of the, you know, indie music from the late 80s, the Stone Roses types, you know, era, Blur. And then we had Oasis. And it kind of felt at that time that this didn't really work for me. So I enjoyed all those same presenters, but I didn't like the music that they were playing anymore. So I gravitated towards Radio 2 in that period, and then was perhaps quite surprised that some of those presenters, but not the ones that we're just talking about, not the Simon Bates or the Bruno Brooks, who might have been perceived in the Bannister era as dinosaurs, but it was the Steve Wright. I think Steve Wright was one of the first who made it over to Radio 2. And this was only a year or so after he'd finished doing the Breakfast Show on Radio 1. And he chose to leave the Breakfast Show. So some of the presenters who made it to Radio 2 were not the ones who'd passed their sell-by date. They were presenters who were, I think, deliberately recruited in order to be fresh and to represent the new era, which is why these days you have Zoe Ball and obviously not Simon Mayo anymore, but all sorts of presenters who were quite cool in their day on Radio 1, who within a matter of years rather than decades became established figures over on Radio 2.
Well, I want to go down that journey with you with Radio 2 in a second, but just to round off talking about presenters, Dave Lee Travis in particular has highlighted in the past the characters of Smashy and Nicey, and I guess latterly Alan Partridge as being part of the downfall. Honestly, to me, that always felt like scapegoating, because if it wasn't for people like Dave Lee Travis, those characters wouldn't have come to being anyway. They didn't just come out of nowhere. But looking back, the time when Harry Enfield introduced, the Smashy and Nicey characters, to me, they actually seemed not an unfair representation of how many of these older DJs were. You're a few years older than I am. Would you agree with that general perception the public had?
Yeah, and it fitted completely. So that very era when I said that it was, Bruno Brooks symbolised it, and of course Simon Bates left not long after, then Smashy and Nicey were even doing Top of the Pops, and they were doing it. And occasionally there would be programmes that they would do, comedy shows where Alan Freeman himself would join them. And he was game for a laugh on this. He knew, he was well into his 60s at that point, and I think he thought it was perfectly fair game. But it was rumoured that Davey Travis and Noel Edmonds, of course he wasn't on Radio 1 at that point, but didn't really like it because they felt that they were demeaning them. I would personally take the line, it's a bit like those spitting image puppets where the politicians, Edwina Curry always comes to mind, they would much rather be on spitting image and have the proverbial taking out of them than not be on it at all. So I do think it was the end of the era, because you'd have the Smashy and Nicey thing, which kind of really got to grips with those sort of radio caricatures and those transatlantic accents that various presenters like Tony Blackburn had. And I think that was the sea change. That was the time when actually they were being mocked a little bit. And that somehow, if you're talking about a youth station, for me, it never meant that they were anything other than excellent broadcasters. It just meant, and for me, it was the music. I stopped writing down the charts on a Sunday, not because I got bored with it, not because it wasn't something I wanted to do, was because I didn't care anymore for some of the stuff. I think, New Kids on the Block or whatever, just I thought, it's not for me. I'd moved on. So my radio interest had never changed. The stuff that I grew up with in the 80s hadn't changed, but I found that Radio 2 offered me that transition and actually was more indicative of the sort of musical taste that I had, and which the oldies programmes on Radio 1, I think Mike Reed had his Sunday afternoon oldie show, Simon Bates had his golden hour, guess the hits and headlines from a mystery year, and Simon Mayo continued with that. So actually, if you wanted to hear oldies, music from the 50s even, you could legitimately listen to Radio 1 and hear plenty of that.
By the mid-1980s, Radio 2 had become somewhat of an anachronism. When David Hamilton left it in 1984, he famously said, there's only so much Vera Lynn you can take. Mm. And certainly by the mid-1980s, essentially it was a sports and old-time radio music station. We're talking more like big band kind of era. The controller at BBC Radio 2 at the time, reading back now, they mentioned comparisons not only to the light program, but almost to an ethos of the home service. Yeah. I mean, it definitely took, as their sports coverage increased and became better, it seemed that everything else in the station was becoming less relevant. For some unknown reason, they had Derek Jameson replace Terry Wogan, which, God knows why that ever happened. But, I mean, Radio 2 was in some kind of state. But especially with the launch of Radio 5 in 1990, and news and sport and alternative programming being farmed off to what was then a very low-budget news station. Radio 2 got a new lease of life, as you indicated, with a new generation of presenters coming in. And I guess that kind of coincided with the time you began listening to Radio 2. So what was it, the presenters from Radio 1 that took you to the second network, or was it something else?
Yeah, well, it was something else, because some of those presenters came a little bit later than that. And just a bit, you mentioned David Hamilton, and it's funny because you're right, there's that sort of famous quote when he said that there's only so much Vera Lynn you can take. But in more recent years, of course, David Hamilton, who's still going and is a fantastic presenter, of course, is quite critical of Radio 2 now, because for the opposite reason, that actually it doesn't really appeal to the baby boomers. You know, there's not enough 60s and 70s music on the station anymore. So in a funny way, his reason for being critical of Radio 2 in the 80s in the Francis Lyne era is very different from the Radio 2 that he will be referring to when he's critical of you know, Zoe Ball or whoever. But what I find so interesting about this whole period is that for me, early 90s, I kind of established that the music that I grew up with in the early 80s, mid 80s, was fundamental to who I am. So all the sort of stuff that from 1982, all the sort of, whether it was, I don't know, Shakin' Stevens, Adam and the Ants, Bucks Fizz, whatever it might have been, that was the sort of stuff that I grew up with and I liked. And by the late 80s, that wasn't what the chart scene was really all about. So I kind of experimented with Radio 2. And what I found is that it was a joyous place to listen, because you had what you had there was, and maybe at the time I knew that it was perhaps the end of an era, but you'd have a presenter. Chris Stewart was one of the most wonderful presenters. He was Cardiff based in those days. And he was somebody who would just be sitting in a studio and he would just be talking to the listener. And that's what a lot of the Radio 1 presenters had been doing and allowed to do a decade or so earlier. Zoo Radio kind of changed all of that. And Radio 2 caught up with Zoo Radio, certainly within a decade or more. But you'd have presenters who would just be talking quite quietly, softly almost, and talking to the listeners. And this is the thing that did it for me. So I was at university at this point, and I remember Gloria Hunniford's afternoon show, and sometimes people like Chris Stewart would sit in, and they'd be having interviews, and I'd feel it was such an education, because I'd be working on my university essays at the time. And in the background, or maybe it was in the foreground, maybe the writing of the essays was in the background for this period, there'd be an interview with somebody, and it might be somebody who had written about the Oscars or the charts, or maybe like a carry-on actor or something like that, or somebody talking about the Hollywood establishment. And although they may have been brought in to talk about their latest book, what would happen was this very, it felt like, spontaneous, off-the-cuff conversation. And suddenly I just thought, these are two people talking to each other, and they were talking about the sort of things that maybe people of maybe a slightly older generation were interested in, but it felt very natural, it felt very warm. And I'd sit and just think, this is a really beautiful conversation, and I want to listen, because I want to hear the end of that conversation. And that actually was the inspiration for my Nostalgia podcast, because somebody paid me a wonderful compliment a few years ago by saying that when they've heard some of my interviews, it's like being on the bus and the people in front of you are having this conversation and your stop is coming up, but you think, I want to know how this story ends. I'll just stay on the bus a bit longer because I don't want to get off at this point and miss the end of their story. And I felt that with Radio 2, that it was offering, in an age that perhaps Radio 1 wasn't doing it anymore, longer conversations. John Donne was brilliant at this at tea time. Conversations with people who were very often quite highbrow people. It wasn't just people in the entertainment scene. Often you'd be talking to physicists or sports people, or all sorts of people from all sorts of walks of life. And they were extended conversations. And it just felt that they were being, it was the equivalent, I suppose, of the sort of things you might hear now on Radio 4. So with Radio 2 at that point, it felt like the line between the education and the entertainment was very blurred. I was being educated and I was being entertained at the same time. And that was the perfect backdrop to me doing all my research in those days.
When I look back at Radio 2 from that era, two things strike me. Number one is they had a number of presenters that had an almost timeless quality about them, which is a unique gift in radio. John Donne was one of them. Terry Wogan, obviously. David Jacobs was. And they just had a style that seemed to be able to cut through every era. And every audience member. On the other hand, you had very talented broadcasters like Jimmy Young, who, you know, famously almost had to be dragged out of Broadcasting House in the end. And just recently, I've been doing a review of the career of the former politician and political journalist Brian Walden. And throughout the 1980s, Brian Walden did a number of interviews with Margaret Thatcher. And, of course, during the same period, Jimmy Young did the same. And I can't help but feel those interviews were the making of Brian Walden as a presenter. But in many ways, Jimmy Young moving into a more news and current affairs was the beginning of a very gradual downfall. And not because he was interviewing Margaret Thatcher. He could have been interviewing any political leader at a time of great political contention in the United Kingdom. And looking back now, I'm kind of surprised when you mention entertainment and education blurring itself. Does it strike you now that, you know, presenters like Jimmy Young, perhaps with stronger leadership, should have been moved away from that kind of area of radio broadcasting and focusing more on what they really specialised in?
Yeah, and that's a really good point, because Jimmy Young, of course, was huge in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And then when I read Jeremy Vine's autobiography some years ago, he mentioned that how interesting that Jimmy Young had no training in journalism. You know, he was literally somebody who was given a job without that sort of training. You know, he didn't come from the BBC news team. He was a crooner, and as a crooner, he was given a job, as you say, interviewing all the big people of the day. And I think was it Nigel Havers, who was, you know, the famous actor, and, you know, he was working as a younger man as a researcher on the Jimmy Young show. And the reason Margaret Thatcher was interviewed by him is because he had access to her through his various connections. So of course, we in later years, I grew up knowing the Jimmy Young who was on Radio 2 at lunchtimes on a weekday with his News and Current Affairs show. And perhaps it was always curious to me to square that with what had been going on with you know, the Unchained Melody hits in the 50s, and when Jimmy Young was asked, I heard this handover with Mark Goodyear, who was sitting in for Ken Bruce around 2002, when another version, was it Gareth Gates or Will Young, whatever, of Unchained Melody hit the charts, he actually said to Jimmy Young, gosh, you know, you were the one who had the first one, and there've been others along the way, so how do you feel? But Jimmy Young, you know, kind of didn't really want to talk about it. It's interesting that was almost as though you are, you know, who are you? You're asking about the charts. You kind of felt that he was no longer in that kind of field. And, you know, Jimmy Young himself, I'll be honest, he would play Blondie and say that was Dennis. You know, so there was a sense that he was brilliant at what he was doing, but you kind of felt that he was from a different kind of era. And he was obviously told what to play. You know, I it's not like Joe Wiley or even Vernon Kay or today, where they really know the music and they know the artist, probably party with the artists in some cases. But Jimmy Young was always fascinating to listen to, precisely because, and that's what I think Radio 2 was so good in its era, is that he was somebody who kind of was against the spirit of the time. And as somebody who does all this work on nostalgia, I wanted to capture that. It was almost like a privilege to have somebody in my living room, in my kitchen, in my student bedroom, and listening to somebody who my parents, maybe even my grandparents, had listened to before. And for me, that was just special. But it did feel a little bit out of time. And I did always feel, and my friends at university knew I was listening to Radio 2, but, and some of them, I'm sure, listened to it as well, or dipped in and out of it. But in that era, in the Francis Lyne era, I know that was not what most of my contemporaries were doing.
Obviously, we've talked about many DJs and presenters in this show, and clearly not only are you passionate about them, but you were also inspired by them. And when you were at university, you had an opportunity to appear on the quiz show Blockbusters, which was presented by Bob Holness at the time, who was, I guess, one of the first presenters on BBC Radio 1. I'm not sure if he was a regular presenter from its early days, but he was certainly there or thereabouts. And obviously had a long career on independent radio, both in the UK and overseas. I guess that was your first experience of being part of a mass media product. What was it like meeting Bob, and did you pick his brain at all?
I did, and actually, even to this day, because I'm somebody who, as you know, always wanted this sort of, you know, radio career, but followed a different sort of path. When I went on Blockbusters, for me, meeting Bob Holness was the icing on the cake. I mean, I didn't care about winning, but I knew that I was lucky to be on there, because I knew that when we all auditioned at school, what was really obvious, I think now, is that they were looking for quirky personality. So yes, I probably offered that. A lot of my friends were a lot cleverer than me. We all went to the audition together, five or six of us, and I was the only one who was chosen. And I know a couple of the other friends at school were a bit like, but how did you get on? Because you're not as clever as we are, sort of thing. And looking back, that's, you know, it's rude. But I knew it was true. I mean, it was. I mean, you know, there were people at the school I went to who were getting straight A's. I didn't do badly at school, but I was never in that league. You know, I was all B's and C's. So, going to Blockbusters, they went in thinking, well, the person they give the job to will be the cleverest, because it's a, you know, it's a general knowledge quiz. So if you've got good general knowledge, you're going to represent your school and do well. I went on, and I think I won the first game in the set of three, lost the next two to two very lovely, well, they were girls, obviously, because we were only about 17 at the time, from Salisbury. And I never got to do a gold run. But for me, I was on TV and I had my 15 minutes. Actually, it was probably like 25 minutes of fame. So I beat the infamous sort of the dictum, Andy Warhol's famous phrase. And I went on this, and Bob Holness sat with us, and we, you know, in the canteen, and I joked with him once. I said, oh gosh, you know, you're sitting with us here. I thought you'd be with all the executives in the canteen opposite. He said, oh no. And I remember having a chat with him, and I was like thinking, this is Bob Holness. I listened to him on the radio sometimes. He used to do a lot of, you know, Radio 2 stuff as well in that era. And I was really sort of quite intimidated, really. But he was very nice. He did actually, my sort of claim to fame was that he asked if he could borrow my pen so he could sign something or other. And he walked off with it. It was just like a Bic biro. And I remembered, I thought, I can't ask for him to give it to me back. And it was just a blue pen. But that was incongruous. And I was only about 17. I found the whole thing just genuinely very strange, because suddenly I was sitting on this TV show with lots of people my age. And I, if I'm honest with you, Craig, I'm not sure I was like the archetypal 17-year-old. You know, I was a bit nerdy, still am. I love, and that you know, that for now it's like, yeah, come on, I'm 50, bring it on. Being a bit nerdy is, you know, I've sort of had to think, I'm a survivor in that sense. But what was just so really strange is that I was sitting there, and I was kind of never the coolest person there, and I was doing my sort of TV dream, and it was just really incongruous, because I kind of felt that, you know, I was not the person who went out to parties. I was the sort of person who was a bit nerdy in school, and never in with the cool people, and a lot of the other contestants on that show were the coolest people in their schools, kind of thing. So it was a great experience, but it was just one of those, and I was like, oh, I don't know what to make of this. I think I did a lot of growing up in those 3 days at Central TV in Birmingham.
As a broadcaster now yourself, and you know, with your ventures now into television in the not too distant future, I can see, as a commentator, strands going back to the past of commentators. In my case, I was lucky to actually know, and their wisdom has sort of stretched out into my career 35 years up after I first met them. When you look now at what you're doing, who are the people who you can still see those strands of relevance to how you do your job and how they did their job back then? Who are the people who are still your shining beacons of how to do the job properly?
Without doubt, the answer is Ed Stewart. Now, Ed Stewart, of course, passed away in 2016. And I think I may have told you this story before, but I bridged my academic and my radio interests when I wrote a book on Christmas some years ago, Christmas and Religion. And there's a whole section, a chapter indeed, on Junior Choice, Christmas Junior Choice, that Ed Stewart presented. So he left Radio 2 in, well, 2006, his Sunday afternoon show, and in 1999 he finished his regular weekday afternoon show. But he would come back every year to do Christmas Junior Choice, and it was, I think, with the exception of 1 year, it was all live. And then he died just a few weeks after the last one he did, which was Christmas 2015. And on the day that the proofs came for the book from Oxford University Press, I thought, oh, I'd love to know what Ed Stewart makes of this, because, you know, I'm writing this book for an academic audience, I suppose, all my students, my peers, but it's about his programme. And I really wanted him to read this. And that day he died. And it was just one of the most extraordinary things, because that day I put the news on in the car about 6-7 in the evening, and it was the Lisa Tarbuck show, and she was playing Champion the Wonder Horse. And do you know, one of those moments I thought, why is she playing this? Because I think Ed Stewart had played it on Christmas Junior Choice just 2 or 3 weeks earlier. And in my mind, I thought, I hope they're not playing it because so he's died, you know. And I just thought, what, you know, it seems incongruous. It's great that they're playing this, but that was, you know, it wouldn't normally appear on any other sort of program outside of Christmas time. And he had died. So that was almost the kick for me to say, if I'm going to do anything, it's a way of almost honouring the fact that, you know, there were people on the radio who were so good at their craft, and Ed Stewart was that. He would talk, he had a very warm voice, he had a very authoritative voice, and I think maybe a bit vulnerable as well in some cases. I think he was somebody who was, you know, doing his sort of stuff in the afternoons. He was never the coolest guy. Politically, he was sort of well known for having political views which were perhaps not always, let's put it this way, he was a conservative voter, but I would see in him somebody such a beacon of professionalism. And I would listen to him, and he would come on the radio, and whatever he did, he sounded so excited about everything that he said. And when I'm presenting my, as I said, presenting, interesting, because when I'm lecturing to my students, somebody once said, it sounds as though there's almost an element of you're doing your radio show. And I've joked to people and said, you know, yeah, when I'm lecturing my students, I'm really channeling the sort of the Ed Stewart. I'm teaching my students as Ed Stewart would do his radio show. The only thing missing is Sally Traffic and the news at the top of the hour and the jingles, of course, although incorporating jingles into lectures probably wouldn't be a bad thing. And so for me, that is the most, you know, a good way to sort of walk into the lecture room, a sort of Chris DC. And I would listen to his programmes and just think, he knows how to do his job so well, so expertly. He's been doing it all his life. Like Tony Blackburn, he has the voice for radio. And for me, his passing and the fact that I never got a chance to meet him was for me a sign of this is not good enough. So that I missed the opportunity on that front. So I have to almost like honour it in some way. And so the book was a way, and I think I dedicated it, you know, in the introduction, I acknowledged the fact, you know, there was a whole chapter in the book written about somebody I'd never met. But without doubt, I think in terms of longevity, he is the presenter. Even to this day, listening to some of those old programmes, when he was sitting in for Terry Wogan a few times when Wogan was ill, you always just felt this was somebody who just loved being there. You know, he had that reputation for being a bit stingy with money. But you kind of almost felt that, you know, if he had to do it for free, you know, he would do it with just the same sort of level of energy and excitement.
Back in 1969, Sports Night with Coleman had a competition to find a commentator to go and join the BBC in the World Cup in Mexico. And Ed Stewart was one of the six finalists. And one of the criticisms of, they took him off to commentate on one of the home international matches, England versus Wales. And one of the criticisms of his commentary was, if anything, at that time, he lacked the authority and gravitas needed to be a football commentator. He, you know, every pass was met with the same level of excitement as when, a player hit a 35-yarder into the back of the net. And that certainly works against him there. When I look back at Ed Stewart, you use the word vulnerable. I think that's a very good word for him, because, and you mentioned how Tony Blackburn has this voice. Tony Blackburn has this voice and this, and maybe it's because I've had the opportunity to meet him a few times. He's pretty much a what you see is what you get kind of person. With Ed Stewart, I always felt his personality, radio personality, was a little bit more guarded at a brick wall between who he actually was, this vulnerable person, and the broadcaster he was. And just for me, he was a fascinating broadcaster, because you could almost, if you were casually listening to his show, you wouldn't pick this up. But if you said, I'm going to listen to Ed Stewart this afternoon, you could almost pick little swings of emotion through the show when, oh, it sounded like he's really on the ball. And the next moment, it's not that he sounded any less professional, but you could just tell there was something in his voice that was actually very appealing and very human in a way, and very unique. And I do wonder at some point, especially in Ed Stewart's career, would he have been a person who, we talked about Jimmy Young earlier going into current affairs. Would Ed, do you think it made another dimension? Ed Stewart could have made, maybe have made a transfer over into, say, a program like Nationwide when it was on, or a sort of light entertainment news oriented show. I always thought he'd be very good at that, and maybe that was one kind of like how David Hamilton at one point of his career should have gone into sports presenting. He had all the qualities you needed. And do you think that's something that looking back, Ed Stewart perhaps should have had a crack at?
Oh well, because of course a lot of people will remember him not so much for his radio work as for Crackerjack, and I always think that he worked. Obviously, it was children's TV back in the day, but I do wonder because I think he had the right sort of voice. My sense, and that's a really good question because, like with Jimmy Young, Ed Stewart didn't have that sort of background or training or education, so that he would have been an obvious sort of news journalist. But he did, I think, present the Radio 1 Newspeak program in the early days. I think there are clips available of him doing Radio 1 Newspeak in like 1972 or something like that. So obviously he was established at that point. So he could have done the news bulletins, and he had the voice. Because Ken Bruce, of course, used to do news, before he became a Radio 2 presenter. And I think Ed Stewart could absolutely have worked in that context. Maybe the analogy is with someone like Maura Stewart, because Maura Stewart was not a trained newsreader. Sorry, she was, but she was an excellent newsreader. She was probably the best. But she wasn't a journalist. So she couldn't have done the Newsnight type programmes. She could present the news, but when it came to interviews, she, wasn't quite able to do what John Humphreys or Jeremy Paxman could do. And I think it's the same with Ed Stewart. I think he could have read the news and presented it, but I don't think he would have been quite in that sort of, maybe he could have been trained to do it. But when it came to music and easy listening type material, he felt very organic. And he would play something and he'd just refer to this, what a lovely sound for the afternoon or something like that. Throw away comments, but it was just a sense that he was clearly listening to the music, reflecting on it. And I said vulnerable because when he would do those like his famous accumulator quiz, I always felt that he'd be talking to the presenter and maybe the presenter had given him the producer, sorry, had given him a script with various bits of information about the person they're talking to, but it actually felt like it was like, I know nothing about you, so tell me all about you. And occasionally he might mishear what the person is saying, or the other person would go a bit quiet, or he'd ask a question and the other person wouldn't sort of quite follow through on the answer, and he would just get a little bit like, oh gosh, I don't know, how to follow this. It would just get a bit awkward. Now, very that he always picked up from that, so there was no issue. But it just felt like this was a real conversation. Somebody who just wanted to meet somebody he didn't really know. I didn't get the sense he'd leave the studio and have all this coterie of people or agents and press officers and going out to the latest parties and sort of living it, and he wouldn't be in all the tabloids. I just imagine that he was a guy who did his show, did it very professionally, but would sort of leave on his own, drive up the motorway, get the train home. And that was what I liked about him, because I kind of saw myself in that. He was doing some very cool stuff on the radio and had wonderful privileges, but he felt like a very, very ordinary person, who was never the sort of person who some of his other colleagues were always, they'd make front page news if they said anything controversial. I think Ed Stewart never was, for reasons that I never quite understood, but was never in that kind of league, because I think professionally he was probably the best on the whole of Radio 2 during the 90s when I used to listen to him.
If I recall, Ed Stewart started his career at BBC Radio Merseyside.
Well, he worked in Hong Kong actually, and yeah, so he but he was on the pirate ships for sure.
I don't know. I've definitely seen some footage of him at least doing some radio work in the Northwest. So maybe I'm transposing some. I know I've seen some footage of him doing like radio news and sports reports and that kind of thing. But no, I think you hit on something when you mentioned, oh, he said, oh, what a lovely tune that was. He was a very, very reflective broadcaster. And you feel now in your work you're trying to continue that legacy and move it forward?
Well, what I think is that, well, in terms of writing about his Christmas Junior Choice, so I've done that and I've benchmarked that and referenced it and quoted from it and all sorts of things. But I also think that, if I had to say who I was channeling, and I'm aware that people today who might listen to me won't know Ed Stewart, but in terms of if I had my own radio show, then I kind of feel that that would be the obvious kind of connection. I think that anybody who used to grow up listening to Ed Stewart, and also I guess, and let's be frank, if I was told, you know, there are two programs or one person program you can present, what would it be? Your dream show. Although probably in terms of my academic work, you might think that something like the Jeremy Vine show would be the obvious sort of thing for me to do, and I'd relish the chance to do that. There are two programs that would be my dream job. One would be Pick of the Pops. The other one would be Junior Choice. So in a way, it's not just that I think I sound a bit like him and really grew up on his stuff, but also I like that music. Now, no one of my generation thinks such, you know, Winifred School Choir or Clive Dunn Grandad, you know, it's stuff I enjoy listening to, that kind of thing. And I grew up listening to that when I was very young.
So we're coming towards the end of our time now, Chris, and, you know, you talked a moment ago about channeling Ed Stewart. And I know in my journalistic career, there's been times when suddenly I've had to read something out, or I've had to present something, and I've kind of got, when I read a script, I've got, oh, I know someone from the past who would have said it like this. And I've kind of tried to riff off that when I've gone to broadcast live for myself. Is there anyone else besides Ed Stewart who, perhaps in your work as a lecturer, you've picked up on someone's broadcasting style and found it to be helpful in your professional career?
Well, yes. I mean, Tony Blackburn's an obvious one because he's still going. And I think the connection between Tony Blackburn and Ed Stewart is a very obvious one. But also female presenters. And I think that we were talking earlier about how it was a very male-dominated sort of network, both Radio 1 and 2 largely. But also, and maybe for the same reason, Sarah Kennedy, who used to do the Dawn Patrol, and she used to get a lot of vitriol in the press. And I think I read somewhere that she didn't have her own agent, and that she was somebody who, you know, was on Radio 2 for many years. And I know she was often ill quite a lot towards the end, and perhaps she didn't leave entirely on her own terms. But she was somebody you never knew what she was going to say. Now, this, if I'm teaching my students, I always have to have some sort of a script, obviously, and you have a job to do, and the students need to have, there are learning outcomes, and you have all sorts of things that you need to do with a module in order to make sure that the students flourish. But when I was listening to Sarah Kennedy, I genuinely don't think that she knew what she was going to say next. And she'd often talk over the music, and she had quite a very sort of posh voice. But sometimes she'd sort of like be, you know, really almost interacting with the music. And it felt quite jarring, quite tonally inconsistent. She'd do a newspaper review, and she'd sometimes get into trouble because she would almost like have this stream of consciousness. She'd say something that just seemed to be a bit non-PC. But I kind of appreciated her because I don't really know what she was like in person. I'd love to interview her, actually. But what I felt with her is that what you saw is what you got. And I just thought that she was doing her early morning show for a few months when Chris Evans had started at the breakfast show in 2010. And you couldn't have two more different styles of broadcasting, really. Chris Evans, who was somebody who was very clearly sort of driven, very commercial, somebody who knew that, you know, he was being paid an awful lot of money for what he did. He was very good at generating publicity. He was very wealthy. And Sarah Kennedy was just a completely, almost sort of by, in comparison, much more of an introverted sort of person. And I always gravitated to those presenters who had almost like extrovert type roles, but were themselves. And I can't speak about her assessing her psychologically because I don't know. But based on what I heard, she was somebody very warm. And I thought that she was extremely good at just interacting person to person. And I think that's all you could ever ask from radio. So although I teach students and have a script, one of the best things about lecturing sometimes is that you interact with the students in the room. You're not just reading something pre-prepared that you delivered the previous year. And you sometimes say, where are the students in the room? When I'm talking to my students in the room and they're sitting in front of me, I do kind of feel that I'm doing what some of those great radio presenters once did, and just feel that you're accommodating all of them, but you're treating each one as an individual. So I think that the radio is probably the most important influence, aside from people who taught me when I was at university, to whom I am indebted for the career that I've had. But there's no doubt that it's those radio broadcasters who have enabled me to get to where I am today.
So to conclude, throughout this interview, we've talked about your journey from being an 8-year-old listening to Radio 1 right up to the current time. Bearing in mind the media landscape is always changing now and changing at a rate that it's never changed before, in 10 years' time, What and who do you think you're going to be listening to on the radio?
Do you know, I was thinking that because some of those presenters like Tony Blackburn are still going, but he's 80 now. And so in 10 years' time, who will we be listening to? Do you know what? Because we're talking now in June of 2023, just a few months after the Ken Bruce sort of saga, because Ken Bruce left Radio 2. I don't know whether maybe Radio 2 would have allowed him to continue for many years, but he went because he thought the time was right. And he was replaced briefly by Gary Davis, who I think is a phenomenal broadcaster. But Vernon Kay. Now, Vernon Kay, I thought, first of all, I thought, oh, okay, Vernon Kay is great. He seems a very nice guy, actually. But I thought, he's doing that slot. He's going to change Radio 2. I'm not going to listen. I listen to him sometimes as I'm driving into work in the morning. And he actually, and maybe it's because Radio 2 realized what had happened and that they were losing listeners to another station. And I find him playing more of the sort of traditional, like classic 70s and 80s stuff than Ken Bruce was allowed to do. He's such a warm character. He's very, very funny, very intelligent, but also knows how to speak to the audience. He's very funny. He sort of ticks all the boxes. He's brilliant at live radio. So in a funny way, I feel, whereas a few months ago there was talk of, will the people who, like me, who've been listening to Radio 2 for years just stop and go to the commercial sector? But I actually think that Radio 2 pulled a blinder because I didn't think that Vernon Kay was going to be the right person necessarily in that slot. But I actually find him very, very jovial. And he actually sort of fits that slot really well. But he's also somebody who accommodates the sort of, the music that the Ken Bruce generation would have listened to. And so something has fallen into place. So I'm actually really hopeful for the future of radio. And as long as there are people like Paul Gambaccini, as long as there are people like Tony Blackburn, frankly, who are still able to do what they can do for as long as they're able to do it, then actually I feel that there might be even something akin to a radio renaissance.
That would be wonderful to see. Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you ever so much, Craig. Brilliant to talk to you.